Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
You know, and it's not even, you know, about the glamour of it and the knowledge of the tidbits and the technical details. It's really about the honesty and transparency. I'm sure with respect to your brand, if somebody were to write to you or call you and ask you about your wine, you would tell them. And you would tell them exactly what it is and what it isn't. And it's important for people to ask those questions, not just their grocery store, but from their winemaker.
Yeah, I mean, what it is fermented grapes, and that's all it is. And that's all it will ever be.
Yeah. And it seems such a simple statement, but, you know, in its pure form, of course, it's, you know, it's exactly how it sounds, but the elevated part happens that you impart your art, your vision, your heart and soul, and that's when it transcends, you know, the given varietal or given blend or given whatever material that you work with, and it becomes your wine.
You know, you're making me seem magic, but it's really the property that does that. I'm just the little guy pulling the strings in the back, and it's the property that makes the big difference. And I share the glory with the property, but its property deserves more credit than I do.
Well, yes, I mean, but you've selected it, you're farming it, and from what I've tasted, I've had your wines on a couple of occasions. Yeah, they're pretty transcendent.
They'll be transcendent long after I'm gone. Those same vineyards, yeah. Hopefully my daughters will be producing those same wines and making transcendent wines long after I'm gone.
I hope so too, because that kind of legacy, you know, I hope it lives on, because we all need that. We need to know that things like that exist, that they're possible in the chaos that we all seem to find. This is kind of an oasis, like I said, of sanity and, you know, true connection. And your wines channel, I mean, it's really, at the end of the day, not about the flavor profile per se, you know, not the descriptors, but it's that soulful element, the fact that you have brought cumulatively so much to that moment, and that happens to be encapsulated in the bottle. But the road to it was so long and so arduous and so wonderful. And that's what I find probably the most exciting and stimulating part of it, is that your wines are conversations.
Yeah, I wish everyone thought the same way you do, because that's exactly how I want people to feel. I make wine because of that moment when people taste the wine and they're just transported, you know, similar to Proust's Madeleine, you know, transported to somewhere where they have an experience that will change their lives.
Yeah.
And I mean, the wonderful thing about wine is it's, you know, it's a vintage date. It's a moment in time that's frozen, and
yeah,
it takes you back. We always play a game, my wife and I, where we, if we drink an older vintage, we'll have to tell each other a story from that time.
What a great idea!
And it really it brings you closer to that, certainly to that wine, but also brings you it enhances your life in a way. I mean, wine's it's an odd thing too, because, you know, it wouldn't have existed if the first guy that, or first woman, or first animal that that found it hadn't gotten drunk. I mean,
that's right.
You think that somebody tried those rotting grapes, they were probably super desperate and very hungry, and they ate all those rotting grapes off of a vine, and they got super drunk that evening, and it was a totally transporting experience. And they probably came back the next day to get more of that. And you think it's such a simplistic idea, but I mean, we wouldn't go through all this trouble if that person hadn't had that experience.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating to kind of drill it all the way back to that very simple notion that caused for all of us to get together today eventually. Well, I know you make very little wine, so those that are listening, they need to make a note of that and do something about it, because if you're not compelled by now, nothing can help you. and I fully mean it, because those wines add so much value, you know, like what you just so eloquently described. It's a friend, it's a companion, it's a confidant, it's a lot of good things. At the end of the day, it's a good feeling. And there's never enough of that.
Indeed, yeah.
I know you're also continuously consulting. As I mentioned in the beginning of the show, you're very highly sought after. So I just want you to mention a few brands that you're currently working with so folks realize that you're responsible for those gems of wine. So I don't mean to make you list them in alphabetical order, but even for me it would be helpful to know what your current roster is of people that are lucky enough to call you their winemaker.
So, first and foremost, Blackbird Vineyards. I've been working with Blackbird Vineyards for since 2007, and it's a very fun project, very youthful project, and devoted to Merlot, which is a fun concept. Seven Stones, I mean, probably the sort of most accolades of any of the wines that I work with. But a tiny 3-acre property, 3.03 acres on up above St. Helena and within the Meadowood Resort facility, owned by two wonderful people, Ron and Anita Warnick. Crazy project that tears at my heartstrings all the time is called Como No. And I started working for this crazy guy, Carl, the Ayatollah Domeini, in 2008 for his project Quixote.
Yes.
He was the owner of Stag's Leap Vineyards, and broke away from that when he sold to Beringer in 1997 and started Quixote, and has dedicated his life to Petite Syrah, and he sold Quixote in 2014 to a Chinese group, and kept a great deal of acreage above Quixote, the best section of vineyard. And he has a little 3-acre vineyard in Stag's Leap that's spectacular. I do St. Helena Winery, which is a wonderful small estate, fantastic site, and wonderful Bordeaux varieties. I have a new project called Fee that's John and Joanna Goldstein started, that's in that marvelous piece of ground that's on the lower slopes of Spring Mountain.
Okay.
And it's a property that's is a little over six acres, and planted to Bordeaux varieties, a little Petit Verdot and Malbec to add to the Cabernet Franc and Cabernet Sauvignon there. That's a marvelous, marvelous vineyard. Adler Deutsch Vineyards on West Zinfandel Lane. Two amazing people there as well. Bob Adler and Lexi Deutsch, both artists and intellectuals in their own right.
Could see the synergy there.
Perlis, it's a pure pleasure working for those guys. It's I was brought in by Herb Perlis, who founded the property, and I was brought in to plant the vineyard. And it's a little property in the sort of foothills of Mount St. Helena in, mm-hmm. in north of Calistoga. And Herb has retired from it and given it over to his very talented children, Anthony and Tessa. And Tessa so loved the world of wine that she decided to start a brand of her own called Wingspan. And Wingspan is old vine Zinfandel from a crazy old vineyard called Del Barba in Contra Costa County, where there's Mourvedre that's 130 years old, wow. Zinfandel over 100 years old.
Crazy.
Crazy, crazy property. And she also makes a wonderful rosé. I was fortunate enough to meet the race car driver, Danica Patrick. And Danica asked me to find a property for her. And shortly after she came up with this crazy dream of finding a property, I found this marvelous property on the lower slopes of Howell Mountain, right next to Viadere, a property that I really admire. And we converted this rock pile into a vineyard, a little over 6 acres as well. And the wine's called Somnium.
Somnium, so what
yeah.
is that?
So Somnium's the opposite of the incubo. It's Latin for the dream. And wonderful pleasure to work with her. She's has a lot more going on than just turning left on a racetrack. She's a very, very talented cook, and she's an incredible fitness expert, and
wow.
Just loves wine.
That's so cool. I'm assuming you didn't meet her on the racetrack. I don't see you showing up and watching a car race. I'm assuming it was an introduction. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, she came to Quintessa, actually.
Oh, okay.
And I happened to, at that time, I happened to be riding a motorcycle, and she thought that was crazy. And
why would she? I'm sorry, but of all people to think that's crazy, I have to know why she thought that way.
I think she thought I was a speed freak.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
I'm not. I'm one of the slowest observational drivers that you can possibly imagine. But you know, one wonderful group of people. I have a crazy K-pop client, a guy named Suman Lee, who sort of invented the idea of Korean pop music and created all the dojos that create these Korean pop bands. And he has a project called Emos.
Okay.
That comes from a couple different vineyards in Napa Valley, Hillside Vineyards. He's a big fan of Bordeaux wines. Mm-hmm. And he's runs an entertainment empire in Seoul that spans most of the world, and he is opening up restaurants all over Asia, and mm-hmm. one in Los Angeles now. And I've met some marvelous people through that mm-hmm. through that project.
Well, you certainly attracted quite a diverse group.
Yeah.
Of individuals with a common thread. They all love wine and they all love you.
You couldn't get them in one room. It would be impossible.
Well, that's such an interesting thought. So maybe not them, but not the, but the wine. Okay. And just have a display of everything that you've crafted. That would be quite a large group.
I also work with Bernard Magret, who's the owner of Chateau Pop Clément.
Of course, yeah.
And I started making his wines when I was working at Quintessa. Michel Roland chose me to make Bernard's wines, and then when I left Quintessa, my good friend Benoit Touquet took over mm-hmm. making those wines and made wonderful wines for him. And then Benoit stopped making the wines, so Bernard came back to me, and we've started making those wines again.
Wow. So I almost wish that there was like a list that we could put up underneath the podcast so people could say, okay, this is all the wines that you make, because they're all so different, you know, but also worthwhile. You know, I attend Atelier and Melka every year during the premiere week. There has to be an Atelier pot, is what I'm thinking.
That's a great tasting, that Atelier Melka tasting. You know, I went for the first time this year. I mean, I figured that Philippe couldn't kick me out if I was the chairman of Premier Napa Valley. And I was right. They had to let me in. So I went to that tasting. Fabulous tasting. It's interesting to try all of Philippe's wines. You know, Philippe and I are old buddies.
Yeah.
Philippe kicked me out of Petrus in 1993. And we've been friends ever since.
He kicked you out of Petrus?
Yeah, I came to... I was, you know, at Trois-la-Mondo at the time. And... Philippe was doing an internship for the Moex family and was based at Petrus. Mm-hmm. And I went over to, you know, rode my bike over to Petrus and was looking around the vineyards just before harvest and, you know, checking out what they were doing. And this little guy comes running out in a Detroit Pistons t-shirt, I remember. And he said, "Hey, what are you doing in my vineyard?"
I didn't see the violent side of Philippe.
Well, he wasn't violent at all. And I said, "I'm, you know, I'm just worshiping St. Peter."
Yeah.
And he immediately clocked my accent and said, "You are English?" And I said, no, I'm American. And I could just see his eyes open wide. You know, he's such an Americanophile, Philippe.
Yeah.
And... his eyes opened wide, and he said, you should come for dinner.
Well, that worked out.
Yeah, no, we've known each other ever since. Wow. Philippe's, I respect his work greatly. And he's certainly, the Atelier has produced a lot of great winemakers, too. Mayan and Megan and many others. Marie-Laure, they're all wonderful, wonderful winemakers in their own right.
No, I mean, again, the pattern continues in perpetuity. You associate yourself with people, or they associate with you, depending on how you look at it. That brings so much value to each other in the wine world. It's kind of, you know, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Robert Mondavi said years ago, that when the tide goes up, all the boats go up with it.
Yes.
So if one person's boat is going up, we're all going up. And I think the more we can do to support each other, and the more we can do to support great wine, the more we do for Napa Valley.
What do you think Napa's future look like? There's a lot of conversations about it, and some trepidation, of course. You know, there's always concerns about the luxury market segment and wine and consumer behaviors and perceptions and things like that. You've now watched it for a few decades and have a really very unique, I feel like, overview, because you had that benefit of perspective, but you're also so deeply involved in so many intricate aspects of what really creates the fabric of the valley. What are your thoughts on that?
I think if we're true to ourselves and we don't follow trends, that we'll continue to make great wines, and those wines will be recognized. I think we need to be true to what this valley produces, and not try to follow trends, no matter what they are. Then I think we'll survive very well. I mean, this is a place that is blessed by having a most incredible and complex selections of soils.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 33 different distinct soil types in a small valley. I mean, it's unheard of. It's phenomenal, the differences, and then all the different climates.
Yeah,
I have a very cold climate site. It's it would make people in Bordeaux shiver at times. And I think there's so much diversity here that you can't put you can't pinpoint exactly what is Napa Valley. So there's so many different Napa Valleys.
That's interesting.
That I think there's always a place for the wines here.
Say more about so many different Napa Valleys, different in climactic, geographical, geophysical sense, or also the human terroir, perhaps.
You know, each if you look at a simple vineyard, you have just differences in the quality of the fruit and the characteristics of the fruit in a small vineyard. You know, I have 5 acres, but I could make hundreds of different wines out of those 5 acres just from each individual row. You know, there are differences in the distance that you can throw a rock.
Yeah.
And based on the different exposures, the variations of soil types, the climate, altitude.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many differences. And I think, you know, you go across the street to something like Mayacamas, it's completely different again.
Yeah. So. You've made wine all over the world. I'm not trying to get you to do a comparison, but I've heard the opinion that Napa Valley truly is the ultimate place to make wine. Do you share in that?
It's the ultimate place to make wine because it's so easy to make wine here. I mean, it makes us all look good because it's so easy to make wine here. You know, it's a climate that's perfectly made for wine. You know, there's very little rain between April and October. You have ideal soils. You have this wonderful fog that comes in at night and cools us down like we're getting right now.
Yeah.
And it moderates the temperature. You have the proximity to the Pacific Ocean that so moderates the temperature. It's a really wonderful climate for growing grapes.
What's in store for your brand and for you? What do you look forward to in the future?
Continuing to make wonderful wines. I don't need to make more wine. I don't need to make more cases. What I need to do is make better wine every year. And what I mean by better is wines that tell the story of my property. I was out in the vineyard today and saw a bobcat. And the bobcat stuck around the vineyard for a while watching us working. I got swooped by a golden eagle today.
Wow.
And that's the story I want to tell. That's what I want people to see when they drink those wines, is the wildness, the view from the top of my property, that you can see the bay, you can see San Francisco. You can see Mount Diablo and Mount Tamalpais. You can see the whole valley.
Wow. So if you were to get the world to pause for a few moments and everybody just stop what they were doing and listen to you, what would you say?
Stop killing the planet. Yeah, I don't know what I would say. I don't know that I have that much to say, really, to everyone in the world. I love life. It's an amazing world. But I find we're getting more and more confused and more getting further and further away from what makes us human. And further away from our culture, from our art, from beauty. I mean, we just witnessed this this week, the fire at Notre Dame.
Yes, very true.
And I mean, whatever your religious beliefs are, who cares? This is a beautiful work of art and a beautiful human work of art. That gets destroyed,
yeah.
You know, and and it's tragic. I, you know, it's sort of indicative of where our world is going, and I don't want it to, I don't want to see it go that way. We need to take care of. We need to start becoming stewards of the land. We need to start thinking about where our food comes from. Thinking about what's going on with the bee population.
Yeah.
Thinking about how many people we are in this world and how many people we can support in this world. We're on a collision course, and there needs to be a change. And I think so much of what creates these problems can be changed at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we need to burn fossil fuels?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we could create enough alternative energy sources at this point. We have the technology to do that mm-hmm. we could totally change that. We don't need to burn coal. We don't need to burn fossil fuels. We could completely change that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing that you think the more aware we become of what we're doing to ourselves and to future generations, the more the opportunity there will be for a mental shift, which then facilitate action. Is that?
I hope so. Yeah, I really hope so.
Well, I know that you're doing your part in your vineyard every day, and I know that we're the lucky beneficiaries of having a treasure like you in the winemaking community and in Napa Valley, and that so many people would be touched by partaking in what you've crafted. And for that, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Mother. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
We got deep. We got too deep.
we got a little deep.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.